disciple as well.
Good morning, Keystone. What a powerful story that we get to hear. Awesome to hear from Kirsten and Chloe. My name is Blake. I'm a church planner here going to Greenville, North Carolina in 2027. Go Pirates. There we go. There they are. Hey, somebody should do something about that. Somebody ought to say something there. You ever said that? Somebody should say something. That's a sentence most of us have said, right? Like you see it at work, something's broken, something definitely needs to be fixed. Everybody knows it, nobody does anything, right? Like somebody should say something there. See it in your neighborhood, see it in your family. Like somebody who's clearly struggling, clearly alone, clearly needs somebody to talk to, and you think, somebody should check on them. Maybe it's bigger than that. Right, some kind of injustice, a need in the city, a hurting person that you go past on your way somewhere else, and that sentence just like runs through our head, right? Like, somebody should do something. Here's what's uncomfortable about that sentence. Usually, we're thinking it, but we're never actually doing it. I've had that moment more than once in my life. I can think of a story. I saw a guy sitting on the side of the road. I think he was homeless, and I was walking down the sidewalk to him, and I had this thought, like, man, somebody should talk to him. And you know what I did? I took the crosswalk. I walked across the street away from him and avoided him entirely. I told this story at youth a couple of months ago. Our awesome youth leader, youth staff team member, Alyssa Romp, she's amazing. She needed some 7 Brew to brighten her spirits. And they're about to go on camp. So if you want to get Alyssa a gift to brighten her spirits before she goes to camp, like tomorrow, banana bread blondie 7 Brew, okay? There you go. That's your task. Alyssa, banana bread blondie 7 Brew. And I'm on my way to get Alyssa this, and I see the lady, the barista, and I'm like, man, somebody should talk to her. She looks like she is like just begging for someone to start a conversation with her. So she starts talking, and it is so clear. And you know what I do? I take the banana bread blondie, say thank you, and I drive away. Like somebody should do something. But I'm quietly thinking the entire time, anybody else? I hope it's not me. Right? At work, we do this. Like somebody should mentor them. Somebody should speak up. At school, we say somebody should sit with them. Somebody needs to encourage that person. At home, we say, hey, somebody needs to apologize first, and it's not going to be me. Someone needs to lead prayer. Somebody needs to lead in our house. At church here at Keystone, we say, hey, somebody should disciple them. Somebody needs to lead that connection group. Somebody should do something about that. What if you're the somebody? Right? Who knows? Maybe it's you. Maybe it's me. Right? That's the question that gets forced onto a queen named Esther in Esther chapter 4. This is the question she faces. She spent years hiding her identity, who she really is, and now she can't hide any longer. Esther chapter 4, go ahead and make your way there in your Bibles. It'll be on the screen behind you. Before we jump in, I want to give us a little bit of context, right? Because if you're coming into the middle of the series, we're about in the middle of the book here. I just want to remind us where we closed. So Haman, this royal guy who's in a high position in the kingdom of Persia, he's a bad dude, okay? We know that. And he is upset that Mordecai, Esther's guardian, is this Jewish man, and he is not bowing down to him. He's not paying him homage. He's not honoring him. So in response, Haman plots to kill all the Jewish people, everyone. And through some cunning words and a little bit of money, King Ahasuerus grants this request. The king of Persia, he grants this request to Haman, and he signs it into law. He seals it. It's done. Everyone's going to die if you are Jewish. So the fate of all these Jewish people at this point in the story, on all accounts, seem hopeless, and it's kind of like Mordecai kind of feels like this might be my fault. I might have contributed to the annihilation of my entire people. They're all going to die. And we pick up in the story, Esther chapter 4. Let's look at verse 1. When Mordecai learned all that had occurred, he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, and went into the middle of the city. And he cried loudly and bitterly. He went only as far as the king's gate, since the law prohibited anyone wearing sackcloth from entering the king's gate. And there was a great mourning among the Jewish people in every province where the king's command and edict came. And they fasted and wept and lamented, and many lay in sackcloth and ashes. Esther's female servants and her eunuchs came and reported the news to her, and the queen was overcome with fear. She sent clothes for Mordecai to wear so that he would take off his sackcloth, but he did not accept them. Esther summoned Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs who attended her, and he dispatched him to Mordecai to learn what he was doing and why. So Hathach went out to Mordecai into the city square in front of the king's gate, and Mordecai told him everything that had happened, as well as the exact amount of money that Haman had promised to pay the royal treasury for the slaughter of the Jews. Mordecai also gave him a copy of the written decree issued in Susa ordering their destruction, so that Hathach might show it to Esther, explain it to her, and command her to approach the king, implore his favor, and plead with him personally for her people. All right, we're going to pause there. This morning, we're running through a big narrative, right? We're in a big story here. And so I just want to give us three movements to kind of help organize this for us, to keep us on track. Here's our first movement we see in this story. The grief no one wants to face. First movement, the grief no one wants to face. Mordecai, he hears what happens. Haman's decree, right? The plan for the total destruction of his people, sealed with the king's signet ring, total destruction, and how does he respond? He tears his clothes, puts on sackcloth and ashes, and he walks into the middle of the city, and he's crying out. He's grieving loudly, bitterly. Everyone can see and hear him. And he gets as far as the king's gate, and he stops. Because as the text tells us, he can't go any further. You can't wear sackcloth and ashes. It's a sign of grieving in this time. Like you can't do that past the king's gate. Kings don't like sad people. We see this again in the book of Nehemiah as well. Nehemiah is the cupbearer for King Artaxerxes, who is the son of King Ahasuerus, or Xerxes, depending on your translation. But it's this king in Esther. It's his son. And he's sad around King Artaxerxes. Nehemiah is, and he's like, you know, what's going on? The king calls him out on it. And he's like, may the king live forever. I'm not sad. Why wouldn't I be sad? And he does this, why? Like, why is he fearful? Why does this fear come over him? Because if you were sad around the king, that could easily lead to your death. You don't do that. So Mordecai, he's standing at the edge of where the law allows, and he's grieving as loudly as he's permitted to grieve. And it's not just him. Verse 3, this same scene is playing out over the entire nation of Persia, the entire empire. Jewish people everywhere, they're fasting, they're weeping, they're lying in sackcloth and ashes. And this is the low point of the entire book of Esther. There's no deliverer in sight. There's no hope. And as far as anyone can tell, there is certain death awaiting them. No way out. You know, as I was thinking about this, I want to take a little bit of a detour of our story here, because if I'm looking at Mordecai's response, you know, and I think some of us need to hear this before we really go any further. Like, it's okay to grieve. Like, grieving and mourning and weeping, it's not a failure, right? It's not a lack of faith. It's okay to grieve. Like, but sometimes we think it's like we're failing if we do this. Or also, like, we can feel kind of both sides of this. Like, we can feel it's failure or a lack of faith if we're the one grieving. And we can also feel like, that makes me really uncomfortable if we're watching somebody else grieve. Like, we just don't know what to do with it. Lack of failure, uncomfortability, whatever you want to call it. There's a counselor, his name is Chip Dodd. He wrote a book called The Voice of the Heart. It's a great book, you should totally read it. And he tells this story. It's not in the book, but he tells this story. He's leading a group, like, counseling session with a group of guys, right? Guys love to talk about their feelings, right? Like, so they're sitting in a circle, and a guy is sharing something very heavy. He's crying. He's grieving. And another guy in the circle is hearing this, so he gets up, walks across the room, grabs a box of tissues, and comes to hand it to the guy, and Chip Dodd almost knocks the tissues out of his hand and says, "Stop. Do not do that. Sit down." That sounds harsh, right? So he lets the whole thing play out, and then he explains something. He says, when we see someone grieving, our initial response is to rush with the tissues to try to fix it. We get so uncomfortable, like, we don't know what to do. So what are we gonna do? I'm just gonna go hand you a box of tissues. I'm gonna make it stop. Maybe it's good intentions. Maybe it's we're uncomfortable, right? Like, your tears make me uncomfortable. Let's wrap this up quickly. We often rush to fix grief because someone else's pain, like, we just don't know what to do with it. Or sometimes we do that for ourselves. We don't know how to address the grief and the pain and the things we're feeling, so we rush to try to fix it in some sort of ways. Sometimes the most faithful thing we can do is just sit in the ashes ourselves, or just sit in the ashes with somebody else. It's okay to sit in the ashes. It's okay to sit with somebody else in their grief. If you're carrying, like, real pain, real grief this morning over something in your family, over your health, over a loss that you've experienced, a fear that you haven't said out loud, like, this text shows us, like, it's okay. It's okay to walk through that. It's okay to grieve. Not just manage some emotions or pretend some kind of, like, false strength that we don't have, but, like, sit in it honestly before God, giving it to him. Somebody has to name what's actually wrong before somebody can do anything about it. And look at what happens in the story, right? Because what somebody's about to do is they're about to hand Mordecai a box of tissues. Word reaches Esther, like, Mordecai is out there. He's in sackcloth and ashes. He's grieving. He's making this scene. He's weeping loudly. And she's overcome with fear. Because look, like, what's her first move? She sends him clothes. "Hey, Mordecai, stop. What are you doing? New clothes. Get out of the sackcloth, Mordecai. Put on some new clothes. Stop what you're doing." Right? That's what Esther, she's doing the same thing that the man in Chip Dodd's story does. She's uncomfortable. This is messy. Grief is messy. And then it's in public, and it's making people nervous, and all these people are weeping all over the empire. So her instinct, she just says, like, "Well, I'm just gonna cover it. I'm gonna fix the outside. Maybe the inside will follow." What do I have to do to fix you, Mordecai? Like, I do this. Like, maybe you do too. Right? Something's going on, something's wrong on the inside, and what do I immediately rush to? Right? You go shopping, new outfit, new purchase, a new project that you take on, a new distraction that you try to do. You try to numb out the pain with however you can do it. Whatever I have to do to not face what's actually going on. You can't fix the inside by just addressing the outside. We see this here. So Esther, with all her position, all her privileges, she tries to do that with Mordecai, and he won't take the clothes. So then Esther, she has to actually ask the question, right? She says, "What's wrong? What's wrong, Mordecai, and why?" So she sends Hathach, her eunuch. She goes and finds out. Mordecai gives him everything, right? The whole story. She tells him exactly what's going to happen. And Esther, she moves here. We'll see she moves from trying to fix something at a distance to now, like, you know, "I'm actually going to address the problem. I'm going to face the problem." Like, knowing there's a problem and seeing there is a problem isn't the same as facing the problem itself. Like, somebody should do something. But somebody still hasn't moved. Look at verse 9. Hathach came and repeated Mordecai's response to Esther, and Esther spoke to Hathach and commanded him to tell Mordecai, all the royal officials and the people of the royal provinces know that one law applies to every man or woman who approaches the king in the inner courtyard and who has not been summoned, the death penalty. Unless the king extends the golden scepter allowing this person to live, and I have not been summoned to appear before the king for the last 30 days. Second movement here. The cost no one wants to pay. So Hathach, he comes back. He tells her what Mordecai wants, right? There's all this back and forth going on. And Mordecai wants her to go to the king, plead for your people. And Esther's response isn't, of course, right away, I'll do that. Right? It's her response is fearful. And it's grounded in real facts. There's a historian named Josephus. He wrote a book called Antiquities. He's a Jewish historian, and he's writing about this time in Esther, and he's saying that around the throne of the Persian king stood men with axes who were just sitting there ready to punish anyone who approaches the throne without being called. This is the law that she's referring to in verse 11. She's like, everybody knows this. Right, the book of Esther, it is full of ironies. There's ironies all throughout this story. Here's one of them. You think about it in chapter one, Vashti, she was the queen. Vashti's gone. Why? Because she wouldn't come to the king when he told her to. Now fast forward to chapter four, Esther faces the possibility of being gone because she's gonna go when the king hasn't told her to go to him. See, the chances of losing her head, if I can say that, are very high. In fact, the only chance of her being able to pull off this entire thing is if the king gives like this nod, a wink, if he extends the scepter to the henchmen standing around him. It actually says that he would motion to them. And the men, like when somebody would walk in, they're surrounded around the throne with axes, they're ready to go. And he would look at them, and whether they say, he says, the king goes, oh no, it's okay, they're fine. Or he gives the nod, and then it's over. She doesn't know what's gonna happen, right? And she's the queen. It's not like she can be like, hey, king, it's me, Esther, the queen, beauty pageant winner, you remember me? It's been a month, right? Can I talk to you for a second? She's gone. This is life or death. Notice this. I think this is genuinely good news for us. Esther doesn't say yes immediately. She hesitates. Right? Most of us aren't the type of people that hear like, hey, somebody needs to risk everything, life or death, who's in? And we just immediately jump in saying like, all right, eyes closed, head first, can't lose, let's send it. We don't do that. Most of us hesitate too. Right, can we be encouraged by that? It's like, well, Blake, how am I supposed to be encouraged by that, right? Hesitate, be fearful, it's okay. I think what's comforting in this is like, God isn't looking for people who have no fear and are just willing to jump into everything. That's a great attribute. Like, we celebrate that, of course. But he uses faint-hearted people. People like Esther, people like us, to accomplish his purposes. Somebody should do something. Well, what's my first thought? Well, somebody's more qualified than me, God. Somebody's better than me. Somebody's more gifted. Somebody's a better leader. Somebody's got more time. Obedience isn't about being the best candidate. It's not about being the most qualified. It's not about being the most courageous. Look at Esther's fear. Right? She should be fearful, rightfully so. But it's about saying yes when God calls, when all the circumstances, when everything comes together in such a way that you are the somebody that must act. And notice something about her fear, right? She's the queen. She is the most, like, she's in the most powerful empire in the world. She has this incredible amenities, wealth. She has servants. She has the wealth of the kingdom around her. And despite all of this, this palace that she is in can provide her no real comfort, no real security. It can't fix the problem. She's queen, right? She has status. She has comfort. She has walls. None of it can protect her the moment that she needs it most. Her palace has become, in a very real sense, a beautiful prison. A beautiful queen trapped in a beautiful prison. I wonder what our palaces are. Right, because we're building them too. Right, we build our careers and think, well, if I can just get promoted, then I'll finally be secure. We build financial security and we think, well, once I have this much in savings, once I have this in my retirement account, then I'll stop worrying. Right? We build reputations. We build palaces of comfort. We arrange our lives so carefully that requiring any kind of sacrifice feels like a threat. Others build palaces of control. Every detail is planned so carefully, every contingency, everything, because if we are in control, if we feel like we have it together, surely nothing can hurt us. Even good things can become palaces for us. Families, relationships, success. Like if we're not careful, we start trusting in God's giftings that he has given us more than God himself. Right, and the irony of this story, it's full of it, is that Esther has everything we would chase. When the defining moment of her life arrives, none of it can answer the question that she's facing. Somebody's got to do something. But the palace can't protect her. It can't save her. You know, I'm reminded when I read this story that I think sometimes God lovingly allows us to like experience the things that we've been leaning on to kind of crumble to prove that it can't hold our weight. I think this happens. Right? He wants us to discover that he alone is our refuge. How many Psalms address that? But the Lord being our refuge. Right? And you think about the Gospels, right? Jesus, he never promises his followers a palace. He promises them a cross. He never said, follow me and you'll always be comfortable. It's all gonna go well. He just says, follow me. And here's the difference. Every earthly palace eventually fails. Careers end, money fluctuates, health fades, people disappoint us, right? But the refuge that we find in Christ, the security we find in Christ, like he has never failed one of his people, ever. That is the safest place you can be. It's not inside this strong palace. It is inside the will of God. It is seeking refuge in him. And Mordecai, he calls Esther on this. Look at what he says in verse 12. Esther's response was reported to Mordecai, and Mordecai told the messenger to reply to Esther, "Don't think you will escape the fate of all the Jews because you were in the king's palace." You can't escape it. If you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will come to the Jewish people from another place, but you and your father's family will be destroyed. Who knows? Who knows? Perhaps you have come to your royal position for such a time as this. This is the hinge point of the whole chapter. Maybe the hinge point of the whole book. So look at what Mordecai does. Slow down. We'll slow down right here. He comes back to Esther in three parts. First, he says the palace won't save you. We've talked about this. Whatever safety Esther thinks she has because her position, because of what's surrounding her, it is all an illusion. Hiding is not an option. She is in a beautiful prison. Second, he says deliverance does not depend on her alone. Verse 14, right? If you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will come to the Jewish people from another place. Right, this is huge. Very easy for us to miss. Mordecai is telling her God's purpose for his people are bigger than her obedience and her disobedience. It's bigger than any one person's success, failure, whatever you want to call it. If she says no, God will still keep his promise. He will find another way. Does that mean her choice does not matter? Of course it matters. It matters immensely, but it's not the thing that's holding up the universe. God will be faithful to his promise. It doesn't depend on her alone. Third, phrase we've been building toward, who knows? Perhaps you have come to your royal position for such a time as this. He doesn't say, God told me this is your purpose. He doesn't claim special revelation here. He asks a question. Who knows? That matters. Like we can't know things in advance, right? We can only ever see it looking back. Have you experienced that? Like looking back on your life, looking back at things that happened, looking back at circumstances, and see how God has been preparing you for the moment that you just walked through. You're like, wow, I had no idea. This is why this matters for you and me. Right, some of us, if we're being real, we're waiting for a burning bush moment. We're waiting for this special revelation, a clear sign, something that is just undeniable, a voice, certainty about how it'll all turn out. I have this conversation all the time with people. Like I sit down and talk to people about like, what would it look like for God leading you to go to Greenville, North Carolina to be a part of our launch team? And this conversation is real. Abby and I had this same thing. It's like, man, it would be really easy if God would just write in the sky, you were supposed to go to Greenville, North Carolina. And wouldn't that make things simple? It's like, okay, I know what my next step is. But it doesn't work like that. It doesn't happen. God uses ordinary things. He uses people around you. He uses community. He uses his church. He uses his extraordinary word, everyday faithfulness to shape you. Like Esther doesn't have any clear sign, any clear anything. She had a hard question and a decision in front of her, and that was it. Like somebody's got to do something. Who knows? Who knows? Maybe it's you, Esther. Maybe God has been preparing you for this moment for years. Have you ever noticed how we want God to give us the whole story before we ever take the first step? I want that, right? We pray things like, God, if you show me exactly how this conversation will go, I'll do it. God, if you guarantee they won't reject me, I'll invite them into church. I'll share the gospel with them. God, I promise that if my generosity won't just affect my finances a ton, I'll give. God, if you just show me where this calling, this move on this church plant, where my life will end up in the next 5 years, then I'll obey, I'll do it. Man, I live in that. It's almost never how God works though. Right? We go through the whole story of the Bible. Think about Abraham. God didn't give him a map. God said, go to the land that I will show you. Think about Peter. Jesus didn't explain every single trial he'll face. He didn't explain everything that's going to happen. He just simply said, follow me. The disciples, after the resurrection, they didn't know where the gospel would spread or what it would cost them. They just took the next faithful step. And whenever they didn't step in the book of Acts, God sent them out anyway. Said, you're going to go. Right? God often gives us enough light for that next step, not the next 10, not the next 10 years, not the next 5 years. And that's where Esther is. Right? She doesn't know chapter 5. She doesn't know chapter 6. Spoiler alert, she doesn't know that the king is going to extend the scepter. She doesn't know that Haman's plan will unravel, that God will use her as the deliverer. She doesn't know any of that. She only knows what obedience looks like in that moment. Who knows, Esther? Who knows? Verse 15. Esther sent this reply to Mordecai, "Go and assemble all the Jews who can be found in Susa. Fast for me. Don't eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my female servants will also fast in the same way. And after that, I'll go to the king, even if it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish." So Mordecai went and did everything Esther commanded him. Here's another one of the ironies that we see. Mordecai is Esther's guardian. He raised her. He's telling her all throughout the book what she needs to do. Like right in chapter 2, he was like, "Hey, you need to conceal your Jewish identity." And then just a second ago, we see him say like, "Hey, you can't conceal your identity anymore. You're not secure in that palace. You can't hide, not in the palace, not anywhere." Like, now she can't do that. And watch what happens here. The relationship flips. Mordecai now goes and does everything that Esther commands. The one who raised her, the one who shaped her, the one who told her what to do her entire life now helps carry out her plan. Mom and dad, that's a reminder that formation happens long before the moment arrives. Like Mordecai spent years, he's shaping Esther for a moment that he never saw coming either. We do the same thing with our children. Who knows? Who knows? Third and finally, the move no one expected. The move no one expected. So Esther, she's now giving the orders for the first time. She said, "Go, assemble all the Jews who can be found in Susa, fast for me." And three things are happening here in her response. I want you to see these three things very quickly. First, she's committed, right? She's committed. She's decided, like, somebody should do something. She says, "I'm the somebody." She's committed to this. Second, she's connected. This isn't a solo act of heroism for her. She calls the whole community into it. "Fast with me, all of you, for 3 days." Whatever she's about to go do in that throne room, she doesn't go in her own strength or her own cleverness, her own words, her own whatever. She goes in carried by the fasting and the prayers of her people around her. She's connected. And third, because it has to start with a C, she is consecrated. "I will go to the king, even if it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish." It's not being fatalistic, right? It's not whatever happens, happens. This woman is placing her life in God's plans on purpose with her eyes open. She has decided, "It is better for me to die being obedient than to live in disobedience." Notice what happens to her identity. For years, she has been living in the shadows. Hiding, Persian in public, Jewish in private, never fully disclosed either way, right? In this crisis, it forces her out of hiding. She has to decide finally who she really is and who she really serves. Some of us, we're living in this moment of in-between. Like, we privately believe certain things, but nobody at the office knows. Nobody on the street knows. Nobody in our family really knows what we actually believe or where our allegiance actually lies. But sooner or later, something will force the question, who are you actually, and whom do you actually serve? Esther becomes the somebody. Not because she has certainty, not because she knows how this story is going to unfold, but in spite of not having it. She steps forward in faithful obedience. Here's the good news this morning. We're not asked to have more courage than Esther. This is an epic story. But here's what we have. We're asked to trust a far more certain king. Like Esther, she's walking towards this throne room. She's not knowing what's gonna happen. She's saying, "If I perish, I perish." She doesn't know if she's gonna live or die. She doesn't know how the story will end. Right, but we look at this story through a different lens. When we consider this story in light of the gospel, Right? When we consider the life of Jesus, Jesus is walking towards the cross knowing exactly what it would cost. He didn't say, if I perish, I perish. He willingly gave himself. He went to the cross, absorbed the judgment we deserve, rose from the grave so that people who could never save themselves could live. So when we step into our own who knows kind of moment, like somebody should do something about that. Every one of us has them. We're not stepping into the same uncertainty Esther faced. Can I tell you, friend? I have confidence in the gospel that I know how the story ends. We know how the story ends. The greatest who knows moment in history has already been answered. It's at the cross. It's in an empty tomb. God has shown us exactly how far he will go for his people. And maybe you're here this morning. You've never trusted Jesus. Maybe you've spent your whole life and you're building your own palace, but whenever you really step back and look at it, it feels like a beautiful prison. Your own security, your own identity, your own way of trying to make life work. But eventually we all discover that the things we build cannot hold the weight of our lives. Friend, the good news of the gospel is that Jesus didn't come for a people who had it all together. He came for a people who needed to be rescued. He went to the cross to do the thing that we could never do for ourselves. He took our shame, our sin, our guilt. He offers us forgiveness, new life, and a hope that can't be taken away. You don't have to try to keep saving yourself. The King has already come to save you. We don't know how our story turns out. I don't know what tomorrow looks like for you, but I know how his did. That's why we can move in faith. That's why we can move forward in confidence. Pastor Brent said this a few weeks ago, and it's worth reminding us, God can position you for his purposes in circumstances you would never choose. Esther didn't choose the palace, but she wasn't there by accident. You're not where you're at by accident either. God has placed you in a unique position for a unique purpose. So maybe the question is, like, somebody should do something. Who's going to do it? Maybe the question is, Lord, what are you asking me to do? And who knows what will happen? For some of you, that somebody moment is sitting in the row with you this morning. Maybe it's a conversation you've been avoiding because you don't know how it's going to go. Maybe it's forgiving someone you hurt because you don't know what's going to happen with that relationship. Maybe it's stepping into a community here at Keystone in a connection group instead of staying hidden and staying in the shadows. Maybe it's discipling somebody who God has placed in your life. Maybe it's opening your home, sharing your faith, serving your church, saying yes to God, something God has been putting in front of you, right? We spend so much time asking God for the next 5 years, but we don't look at what he's already shown us the next faithful step is. Who knows? Who knows what God might do through one conversation, one act of obedience, one invitation, one yes? Who knows what God might do through your story? You have a powerful story to share, friend. Who knows what would happen when ordinary people stop waiting for somebody else and say, here I am, God. Don't leave wondering today who that somebody is. Just might be you. And who knows what God might do through one surrendered life committed to him. Can you pray with me? God, we thank you for your word. God, we thank you for, God, your kindness in the next step. Lord, the way that you reveal your goodness to us, the way that you comfort us and show us what's ahead. So God, for all of us who are facing that who knows moments, that we see something and say, somebody should step up. God, I just pray that we would have the courage because we know how the story ends. say, Lord, I'll move. I'll take that step and I'll trust in your plan and your promises. God, we ask that we would have that kind of faith. Lord, give us that kind of faith. God, we love you and we pray this in your name. Amen.